Hello and a very warm welcome. I'm Renee Paul, an academic GP at King's and one of the faculty development leads for the King's undergraduate medical education programme in the community and in general practice. We've created a podcast series for busy healthcare professionals, educators, clinicians and students. We cover hot topics and top tips in healthcare education. Many of our podcasts are shorter form, 15 to 20 minutes, so you can squeeze them into your schedule. And there are some that are longer form, up to 45 minutes. We really hope you find it useful and enjoy listening. So, a very warm welcome, John. Will you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself?
My name's John Lorna. By background, I'm a GP and a family therapist, although I'm retired clinically now. But I work in now as a full-time educator. I've developed an educational career over the last couple of decades, and I now work full-time, particularly in the areas of multi-professional and interprofessional work and supervision. And I do quite a lot of writing as well. I'm currently a regular columnist for the British Medical Journal.
Yes, I have to say, one of the things I read most regularly is your column. You just make it very, very accessible. We crossed paths recently. We've crossed paths over the years, but you helped with a session we were doing on interprofessional supervision. And one of the things that really struck me that made me think about, you know, having this conversation with you and sharing it with others was it started with the difference between interprofessional and multiprofessional, which I hadn't really given a lot of thought about before. And I wondered if you could expand on that for our listeners and tell them how you see that difference.
Multiprofessional really refers to any activity where more than one profession are involved. But it could be something as simple as a lecture. It could be quite passive learning where you just simply get people in the same room and you address them together. Interprofessional suggests something much more interactional. So it's professions learning not only with each other, but from each other. And in the context of interprofessional supervision, it follows that it means somebody from one profession supervising somebody from another or being supervised by somebody for another. So it's that cross-fertilization of skills, if you like, that interprofessional refers to.
Starting with definitions, I wonder, one of the other things that I found really useful was how you described supervision, and you sort of split it up into super and vision, and the difference was whether it's a top-down approach or a side-by-side approach. I wondered if you could say a little bit about supervision and how you see it.
It's interesting that the word supervision itself in English is understood in different ways in different contexts. I mean, if you're talking about somebody in a supermarket managing staff on the till, supervision quite clearly means looking over their shoulder, making sure they're getting it right, following all the procedures, etc. If you move to some quite different context, like counselling or social work or psychotherapy, supervision is understood as something much more formative, something much more supportive, rather not looking over somebody's shoulder, but looking after them, helping them. Now, actually, that ambiguity is quite helpful, because if you look closely at any form of supervision, you realize very soon that it has to involve both aspects, or what I call the two faces of supervision. You have to keep an eye on professional standards, you have to look at their duties and whether they're fulfilling the regulations and so on, but you also have to look after them. It has to have a pastoral side to it. Even a very experienced colleague, even if you're supervising a very experienced colleague, you still have to accept that they could get things wrong, they could not be sufficiently up to date, etc. But equally, if you're doing remedial work with somebody where your task is primarily to help them raise their standards, you still need to look after them, you need to be kind to them. So I think of those as two overlapping dimensions of supervision that you always need to bear in mind.
A thought just popped into my mind about the fact that people often don't see themselves as supervisors if they've not had formal training. Yet often people are doing these roles formally or informally. Day to day in practice, I feel like most of us will undertake some sort of supervisory role, but might not see ourselves with that particular hat on. And does that matter? Does it matter what we call ourselves when we're doing that?
I think it helps to make people aware that there is inevitably a supervisory role to being a professional, whether you label it as that or not. When I run supervision training activities, I sometimes ask, you know, does everyone here supervise? And you'll get people saying, well, no, not really. But then you say, well, you know, if you're a GP, for example, does your practice nurse ever stop you in the corridor and ask you advice about something, or vice versa? You know, do you sometimes stop your practice nurse over coffee and say, look, I've got this issue, which I think you probably know more about than me? And that is actually supervision. Ideally, I would hope that everyone should come into work every day with two hats on, recognizing that they are both a clinician, but also a supervisor or an educator, that you can't actually do one role unless you are quite literally working on your own, which is almost unknown these days. You can't not be a supervisor.
Yeah, I agree. And I know you've been a big proponent of everybody in general practice and the NHS and clinicians and educators having supervision in the way that some of our colleagues will in psychology and psychotherapy. And I wonder whether that's where some of this work that you do about making this accessible to everyone, where that's come from. Is that the reason that you started getting interested in this, because you felt we were doing this, but maybe not so formally?
This is where I drew on my background as a family therapist as well as a GP. I'd been a GP for about a decade, I think, before I trained as a family therapist. And I was just immensely struck by the fact that it would be almost unthinkable to see a family without having a conversation beforehand with a colleague about what you're expecting, what you gleaned from the referral letter and the notes and so forth, and to have a debriefing session afterwards about what had happened. One of the things that struck me then was that much of the work I was doing as a GP and much of my colleagues' work was actually far more complicated than we were seeing in a mental health trust, arguably in far more need of supervision than a lot of the therapeutic work that I was engaged in. So a lot of my work over the last 20, 25 years or so has been encouraging people to want supervision, to request supervision, to see it as something that should be like the oxygen of our professional work, that it's actually hard to breathe, hard to function as well as you might without having regular supervision in some form or another. And it needn't be formal, regular, structured supervision. It just means a reflective space, using the weekly clinical meeting, using the MDT as just a space for thinking about cases, thinking about the support you need with particular cases, just building a climate, an atmosphere of supervision in the workplace.
I completely agree. And I wonder whether that leads nicely on to why there is a rise in interprofessional supervision particularly.
Well, there's a number of reasons. And I guess the main reason is the growth of multi-professional teams, but also within multi-professional teams, the increasing skill set, particularly of people who are not doctors, so that you're far more likely to have not just a practice nurse in a general practice, for example, but an advanced nurse practitioner, advanced clinical practitioner. The same goes in relation to pharmacy and a lot of the other primary care professions. The skill set is rising. And in that context, it seems perfectly reasonable to ask somebody who is not a doctor to provide supervision, for example, at times to GP registrars. Equally, as GPs take on these complex teams or work with these complex teams that might include paramedics, might include physician associates and so forth, it's far more likely that GPs will be providing supervision for such people. But there's another dimension as well, which is that some clinicians are now actively seeking supervision from other professions. A GP seeing psychologists, for example, to get supervision on complex cases is a clear example. Asking for somebody from another profession in order to get perspective on your casework.
You have helped groups to set up little supervision sets and given them the tools to be able to do that for themselves as well. Are there any downsides to this? I mean, it sounds wonderful. It sounds like we should all be doing this and it should be built into and embedded in our practices. Are there any negatives or cons or things we need to be aware of?
There are definitely challenges. I wouldn't call them downsides. I call them questions that need to be thought about. A lot of professionals feel, well, I'm not qualified to do this. I don't know what the competences should be. For example, if I'm a doctor supervising a paramedic or a pharmacist, I don't know the regulatory structures they work in. I don't know what are expected standards in relation to particular areas of knowledge and so on and so forth. And I think the answer to that is to have a very clear understanding of the person who's doing the supervising with the person they're supervising, but also of any other agencies involved. For example, a paramedic may be doing a training within a higher education institute, and they may have another supervisor, even an academic supervisor within that HEI. And it's very important to have some kind of conversation and some kind of agreement. You know, what am I responsible for? What are you responsible for? If there is a concern, how do we communicate? Where does the buck stop, for example, in terms of if there's a question over whether they have satisfied a competency that they need for their accreditation? It's really important that that's established. There may be differences in employment. GPs traditionally used to employ everybody who worked under their roof. That's far less likely to be the case now. They're far more likely, for example, to have a pharmacist or a first contact care clinician like a physiotherapist who is employed by the primary care network, by the integrated care board. And then you get issues of if there are concerns about that person, where does the buck stop? Supposing, some kind of formal inquiry or even, you know, the worst case, a disciplinary is needed. Where is that held? How is that organized? And I think, as I say, I don't see these as problems. And when I teach about interprofessional supervision, I simply list them as things you need to think about before you embark on this kind of engagement.
It's also making me think about how we document these conversations. And in my daily clinical practice, I'll supervise trainees, our physicians associates, our physiotherapists. And it's just making me think about how do those conversations get documented? It's usually I discuss with Dr. Paul, but I'm just wondering whether I need to give it a bit more thought.
I have to say, in my work, I come across certainly every week, if not every day, muddles that have been caused by people not being adequately transparent with the person being supervised and with any other agencies and supervisors involved about what's going on, who's paying whom, who is accountable to whom, or being transparent about that by having no record of it. So that 6 months down the line, the person you're supervising said, well, I was never told that you wrote reports to the person at my higher education institute or to the educational leader at the primary care network or whatever. I'm very surprised by this. You know, if it's written down, you can say, well, this was made clear, if you like, in a kind of contract that we shared. And it was made clear that if there were concerns about you, that these would be discussed. All those things need to be transparent and recorded.
And I was also thinking very practically, just in the patient records, now that patients have access to their records, they will know that whoever they saw is going to go away and discuss it with the supervisor on call, who's usually a more senior GP at the practice. I think usually there is a line written. It's just making me think more widely about how we have these honest conversations and how we document them, and so that everybody is on board. We've talked about the fact that this is happening in practice. One of the things that I have seen you do is the fishbowl exercise. It's not hard to do, and I think it works so well when I have seen you do it and encourage others to do it. And I wonder whether you could describe it if someone wanted to actually give it a go.
I do a lot of activities where people say, I would love there to be, for example, proper case supervision in our weekly clinical meeting, in our multidisciplinary team meeting, but I don't really feel competent to do it. I've never been trained, for example, as a Barlink group leader or a Schwarzschild facilitator, or, you know, all these formal methods of supervision and facilitation, but I'd really like to do it. So I teach a very, very simple approach, which draws on those things I've mentioned and other sources as well, that really anybody can see one, do one, and teach one. And it simply is, if you, for example, got, say, six clinicians in a circle, if somebody has an issue or a problem, a clinical dilemma that they wish to discuss, you simply give them 5 or 7 minutes to tell their story uninterrupted. You then have a period of maybe another 5 or 10 minutes where everyone in the team, it has an opportunity to ask them questions. And I usually say the questions should be questions of fact, you know, tell me more about this person. What age were they? Do you know anything about their family, etc.? They could be questions of context. Was this the first time you've seen this person? So on, do you know other members of the family? But what they mustn't do is start chipping in and giving advice and telling the person what they would do, or, you know, God forbid, start to tell what I call fishing stories about, oh, I had an even worse patient and that kind of stuff. So it's structured and disciplined, but not in a forbidding way. And when you've had that questioning part, you ask the person who's told their narrative just to push their chair back and listen in, not to take any part in the discussion for the next 5 or 10 minutes, and simply to allow the group to chew it over, perhaps to offer suggestions of how to manage the case, perhaps just to reflect on what they think might be going on that hasn't been brought into the narrative so far. You can, before that part of the discussion, ask the person who's told the narrative, you know, is there a task that they'd like to give the group, you know, would they like the group to address any particular aspect of the case or the problem? But very often they'll say, no, I just like to hear them chat about it. So the group then chats for 5-10 minutes. And then you ask the person who brought the story in the first place just to give their brief response on what they're going to take away. One of the advantages of that is it protects people who bring problems or dilemmas to case discussions from feeling bombarded by advice, interrupted by other stories, all the kind of messy stuff that you often get when people try and bring cases to discussion. So it's structured, it's simple, it's easy to learn, it's easy to do, it's easy to teach.
Completely agree, and I think it works well. The listening part is at the beginning is the crucial part. Just thinking, yeah, so many of us with patients, but with kind of colleagues, find it really difficult, that 5 to 7 minutes of not interrupting. And I think in that middle bit of helping people to just ask questions of facts and not come up with their suggestions or taming their sort of advice monsters, I think that's really tricky. So you do have to set that up really, really well. I was just thinking, and maybe it's the way to do that is to say, you will get an opportunity at the end. Yeah. That is coming, but not in this bit. Everybody would really value this. It doesn't take as long as people think it does, especially for those kind of meatier, trickier cases. I certainly value this approach, and I would, you know, suggest if you've not tried it, that people should try it. I'm just wondering, do you have any top tips on how to do it well and to make sure that the person who brings the story does get what they need out of the process?
My first top tip would be, as they're telling their story, if they stop after 1 minute or 2 minutes for the facilitator to say, anything else you need to know. People often feel they don't have the right to take up a lot of airtime. And I think if you give them 5 or 7 minutes to tell their narratives, they can expand into it. So make sure they do that. My next top tip would be that everyone breaks the rules for the questioning bit. Everybody starts to chip in with advice. As health professionals, I think as doctors especially, we're addicted to giving advice. If the facilitator has to exert one skill, it's just gently to remind everyone, as you said, there will be a chance to give advice at the end, but actually this really is just about questioning. And please, can you try not to embed advice in your question? To say to somebody at that stage of this discussion, how do you think the patient would react if you did X? It's not actually a question. It's actually advice, not very subtly disguised. So that's the other top tip. Again, to help the person who's listening into the discussion phase, the narrator, as I call the case presenter, just hold back and digest. In some places, they actually ask the person to turn their back to the group. I think that's a bit precious. I think it's fine for them to listen in, but also to ask the group not to make eye contact with them, because again, everybody looking at the case presenter can be a bit intimidating, particularly if they're junior. Whereas have people talking into the middle of the room is much more relaxing for them.
And I was thinking this works just as well online, doesn't it? Because the narrator could just switch off their camera and just listen in.
And that's what we ask. If we're doing it online, we would say to the narrator, switch off your camera for that phase.
It's also making me think about, you know, I know lots of colleagues have done coaching courses. And in coaching, there's that is there anything else? And I think, you know, all of these skills are sort of overlapping. And I think we are taught to do those in different contexts and we can bring it to this. John, thank you so much. I think it's been a really, really interesting and useful conversation. And I really hope people will go away and practice. Is there anything we didn't get a chance to discuss today that I have forgotten to ask you that you wanted to mention and have the final word?
That's a lovely question. And thank you for asking it. And on this occasion, I think the answer is no. I think we've covered everything we both hoped for. So thank you very much for asking me.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, John.
We really hope you enjoyed that. What were your thoughts or comments? Leave us a message. Let us know how that landed. What are you going to do differently or try out in your own education practice? And just a quick reminder, the views expressed in this podcast today are those of the individuals involved and not of their respective organisations. Happy learning and thanks for listening.